Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
The human being is in constant conflict. The state of man on this planet is always dealing with the issues of I want and I don't want, and all of morality, and certainly many, many mitzvahs in the Torah deals with how do I want it, resist it, I want, I don't want, I want, I don't want, and following the right approach. But that state of conflict in man wasn't supposed to be, and initially when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam, it wasn't. When Hashem created Adam and Chava, they were so vastly different than we are now that there was no conflict within them. They were 100% clear. They were a very different Bria than we are now. And one of the illustrations of how different they were than we are is a pasuk in Perek Beis that says, "Vayu shneim arumim," both of them were naked. Ha'adam v'ishto, man and his wife, v'lo yus boshoshu, and they were not embarrassed. Despite the fact that they were stark naked, they felt no shame, they felt no embarrassment. And Rashi fills us in, he says, don't make a mistake. Don't think that they were ignorant, they were unaware. Adam Rishon was brilliant. He was in fact so brilliant that Hashem said to the Malachim, Hashem said to the angels, Chachmoso Meruba Mishalchem, his wisdom is greater than your wisdom. And Hashem said, I'll prove it to you. And he asked Adam to name all of the various animals in the world at the time. Now, when we give a name to something, when I call this a shtenda, that's a label. There's no direct correlation between the word shtenda and this item over here. It just happens to be a convenient way to label this item. When Adam Rishon named each of the animals, he defined the essence of the animal. He uptaich. He took the entire essence, both spiritually and physically, of the animal, and in one fell swoop, with one term, defined it. That's what he did when he named the animals, and the Malachim were astounded by the wisdom that he exhibited. That man was walking around stark naked, not because he was ignorant, not because he didn't get it, but very much the opposite, because he understood things in a very different way than we do. And the Sfuno explains why it is, V'loyis Boshoshu, why is it that they did not feel embarrassment? He says as follows, Kiyaz ha'yu kol pulaseim, because then all of their actions, v'chol evareim, and all of their limbs, lasos v'som konim bovad, were only used to serve Hashem, lo lahasig tanugos nifsodos klal, not to attain any of the lowly pleasures, b'ofin she'yeh pulosam ha'zivug, to them, the physical relations, a man being together with his wife, kipulos achila v'ashtia, was like eating and drinking, meaning, when we sit down to a meal, we don't feel embarrassed. We don't feel a sense of shame. They were on such a lofty level that the normal taivas, passions, desires that fill a person were non-existent. When they were physically together, it was an act, l'shem shamayim, was an act of two very holy people joining together. Therefore, says the Sfuno, just like my face, my hands, I'm not embarrassed that you see them, their entire body they were not embarrassed about, because they were living kimat, almost like malachim, almost like angels, well above anything that we can imagine. And that is Adam and Chava before the chait. Chava eats from the Eitz Hadas, Adam follows suit, and they're radically changed. What they've done in that one action is ingest within them all of the taivas, all of the desires, what we call the nefesh abahami, the physical soul of man, the base desires, were now ingested, and they lowered themselves dramatically. Now they put that conflict into themselves, they put that fight, they lowered themselves dramatically. Interestingly enough, before Hashem throws them out of Gan Eden, the pasuk says, V'yas Hashem l'kim l'odom l'ishto, Hashem made for man and his wife, kosnos or, cloaks of hide, of leather, v'yil b'shem, and Hashem clothed them. The Sfuno is bothered by, number one, why does the Torah have to tell us that Hashem made cloaks for them? And number two, why do we have to know that Hashem clothed them? The Sfuno says, actually, there's an important lesson here. Shelo yigarshum arumim, Hashem did not want to send them out of Gan Eden naked. Pen v'lavshum achakach, lest when they got themselves dressed afterward, b'hishtadlusam, with their own attempt, yachshivu sifu mala, they would have assumed that they took on a new level. Meaning, had Hashem thrown them out of Gan Eden, they would have felt embarrassed. They would have felt shame. Why? because now they were on a vastly lower level. Now they were like you and I. They would have been there stark naked. They would have felt embarrassment. They would have made for themselves clothing and they would have put it on. But if they had made their own clothing and put it on themselves, they might well have said to themselves, we're now living on a higher level than we were before. Before, we were running around naked like animals. Now we're modest. We're bali tznius. We act in a much more defined, much more elevated way. We're now in a higher madrega. Therefore, Hashem didn't want them to make that mistake. So instead of allowing them to make their own clothing, putting it on themselves, Hashem put it on them so that they should not think they're on a higher level. The problem with that is that the Sforno seems to be contradicting what he said earlier. Didn't the Sforno tell us that they were on such a high level, and they were so pure, there was no base desires within them? They were able to walk around stark naked because they were totally different. They were on the highest madrega. They were similar to malachim, like angels. Now they've fallen. The only reason they feel embarrassment, the only reason they feel they need to put on clothing is because they're lowly. How is it possible that they would think, well, now that I'm lowly, I put on clothing and now I'm on a higher level than I was before? It sounds ridiculous. The only reason they need the clothing is because they're on a lower level. The only reason they feel embarrassment is because they're much lower. Yet the Sforno is telling us somehow it would be, if they would make the clothing themselves, they would feel on a higher level. And the question is, what's pshat? How could that be? So let me begin in answering this with what I consider a reasonable philosophical position. It is reasonable to say that if one studies a creation and studies its functionality, he can determine what the intention of the creator was. If one studies the functionality of an item, he can tell what its creator had in mind. For instance, if I take a pen out of my pocket and I say to myself, gee golly, I wonder what the creator had in mind for it. Maybe it's a toothpick. That don't make much sense. I don't need that little clip on the front. I don't need the barrel. And every time I get in the back there, I get that blue inky stuff all over my teeth. Clearly not a toothpick. Meaning, if you study the functionality, it's got an ink cartridge, it's got a little clip, it has a spring. The intention of the creator is clear based on its functionality. So too, if a person studies Adam, if a person studies man, and studies some of the features in man, he could quickly discern what it is that Hashem wanted when Hashem created man. What is the purpose of man? What did Hashem intend for man? One can discern that by studying the functionality of man. And to do that, let me begin with two interesting observations about human nature. In fact, two questions. Question number one is as follows. Why is it that man isn't happy? And that question is actually pretty profound. Because we're living in times that are unprecedented. There is more money, more opulence, more wealth than ever before on the planet. And in fact, sociologists love to judge things. They have something what they call objective well-being. Objective well-being they rate by things like dwellings, death rates, dollars, and diets, meaning the physical trappings of man. Never before in the history of mankind has there been so much objective well-being, so much wealth enjoyed by so many. Yet when it comes to subjective well-being, how happy I am, is life good? Apparently man is taking a deep down spiral. And the reality is that man isn't happy. What's interesting is it's not just an immediately modern phenomenon. Bertrand Russell, who was a philosopher, wrote a book in the 1930s basically lamenting the fact that man isn't happy. Psychologists now claim, and they study this statistic after statistic, study after study, they claim that approximately 85 to 90% of Americans today are not genuinely happy. A mere 10, maybe 15% of people are genuinely happy. And I believe the question begs being asked, why not? You've got it all, wealth, freedom, opportunity. You're living in the land of everything. It's all there. Why aren't you happy? And that's question number one. Why is man not happy? And question number two is a bit different. Question number two is, why is it that man is never satisfied? The Gemara tells us, Midi'is Lomana, one who has 100, wrote to Messiah, wants 200. And you'll see this. You'll read about it all the time. A fellow who has more money. He's so wealthy, he could never spend that money his entire life. He couldn't spend it. Yet he pursues more wealth, more money, and you have to ask yourself, what do you need it for? What is your problem? And you read about kings. Now, by the way, if you're looking for a job, being a king is a pretty good job. You own the country. You also own the currency. You own the land. You're it. You basically write the laws because you're it. It doesn't get much better than that. Why is it? And invariably, the first thing the king does is, after he gets his country all set up, borders secure, armies all set, treasury house all built and filled, what does he do? He promptly goes to war to expand his borders. Now, what's your problem? You've got it all. You have peace, prosperity, your land is secure. Why are you risking it all to expand your borders? What is your problem? But generation after generation shows that no sooner does the man settle into his monarchy, gets secure in it, than he decides to go to war with his neighbor to expand his borders. And what you'll quickly find when you study man is that in almost every venture, it's not just the wealthy, not just the kings, but no matter who you are, no matter what you do, there's a need in man to be better, to improve, to reach the next level. Man is never satisfied. And the second question is, why not? Why isn't man satisfied? You've got it. You've arrived. Why aren't you happy? And number two, why aren't you satisfied? Now, to answer this question, I want to borrow something we mentioned in a recent shmooze, and that is something Mesil Sharm says. Mesil Sharm says, if you'd like a mushel, if you'd like a good parable to understand man, he says, imagine the following. There was a princess who lived in a beautiful, beautiful castle, brought up in finery, the best for her. Somehow, one day, she leaves the castle, gets lost in the woods, can't find herself anyway out of the woods, ends up marrying a commoner, a peasant, and that's where she spends her days, lost in the woods, married to this commoner. He's a good guy, and he tries to make her happy. He brings her whatever he can. He makes some wooden kalim for her, some spoons and forks and different things, even makes her beads made out of wood. Everything that he brings her, he tries to make her happy, but nothing satisfies her. Why? Because she was brought up in the palace. She was brought up in finery and luxuries. Whatever he brings her is nothing to which she's accustomed. The food that he eats is coarse. The bedding that he has is bulky and clumsy. There's nothing that satisfies her because she's from above, from a different level. Says Mesil Sharm, that is Adam, that is us. I am speaking to you, came from under the Kisya covered. I was once in Shemayim, put into this foreign land, put into this body, and there's nothing on this planet. None of the pleasures, none of the trinkets, none of the joys that man seeks on this planet brings me any happiness, because I am speaking to you, come from above, like that princess who can enjoy no good from the coarse things the peasant brings her. So too the neshama, the soul of man, finds no enjoyment in this world because there's nothing that the neshama considers chashuv. And says Mesil Sharm, by all rights, the neshama should hate its existence on this planet. The neshama finds no satisfaction from anything here. The neshama feels like a foreign entity, and by all rights, the neshama should hate its existence in this world. And the Mesil Sharm says, oftentimes it does. However, he says, Hashem would not create a creation, put a neshama into a place where it will be unhappy. And he says there's one little change in perspective. If the neshama understands this, not only does it find great satisfaction, it loves this world. If it doesn't have this perspective, it hates its existence. And I'd like to share with you what that perspective is. But to do that, you'll excuse me for a minute for making another interesting observation. Every evolutionist is supported by an altruist. Every professor of evolution who gets on the soapbox and tells you that we've evolved from apes, that's the way it is supported by a very generous benefactor, a magnanimous altruist, a fellow who puts his name on the college campus, puts his name on the hall. The one who proposes the theory of evolution is supported by a very generous fellow. Now, I find that very interesting for the following reason. The theory of evolution states that man evolved from apes. Basically, it's a survival of the fittest game. The fittest ape was the one who begot more children. Those children survived. The less fit died out. Now here's the observation. The fittest ape is the one who takes care of his needs. The selfish, self-centered, egoist ape who only cares about himself is the one who's going to get big and strong. The magnanimous, generous ape who gives his bananas away to other apes is going to be weak and die. According to the theory of evolution, being generous, being magnanimous, being an altruist can't exist. And what that means in plain language is that the evolutionist, his check is signed by a fellow who cannot exist according to his own theory. Because according to the theory of evolution, being generous, being concerned with someone else cannot exist because it would have died out, been killed out. It's the exact opposite of the theory. What's interesting is it's not just the concept of being generous and magnanimous, being an altruist, that's anti the theory of evolution. It's any human personality trait. If you think about the concept of jealousy, if you think about anger, please explain to me how that evolved. Well, it was just anger and it just happened. I know, but anger is such a lofty sort of floaty kind of thing. It's I'm angry, I'm consumed with that. Yeah, but what do you mean you're angry? Where is it? What is it? It's such a lofty, such a difficult to define issue. It is tied directly to the soul of man. That part which an evolutionist cannot even begin thinking exists, but any personality trait that you find in man cannot evolve. Most of them are anti the theory of evolution because by definition, they're not supported by the theory of survival of the fittest, but surely they can't exist by just coming into being and just evolving. Now, the reason why that's important to us is something that the Orach HaTzaddikim says. He says, if you would like to see proof that Hashem created man for Olam Haba, that Hashem created man for the world to come and not his station in this world, he says, study one feature in man. Why is it that man is never satisfied? Says the Orach HaTzaddikim for one reason. Hashem created man to grow. Hashem put us on this planet for a few short years, gave us a chance to grow, to accomplish, to become that great person we were destined to be, gave us the inner nature and need to grow, because that is the reason why Hashem put us here. And he says, if you want to study Olam Haba, if you want to study the world to come, study the fact that man is never satisfied. Why does he always need better? Why does he always need more? Why does he always need to get to the next level? The answer is, he's not satisfied because Hashem created him to grow. Hashem made man in this way because Hashem wants man to grow. That's why we're here. And if you wonder why it is that man is never satisfied, it's not by accident, it's not incidental, that's exactly the point. Man was created specifically for that purpose, put on the planet to grow, and that is his tachlis abriya, why he's here. Now, that being said, I once read an interesting essay by a fellow who was a black young man growing up in the 1920s in America. And he described that when he'd wake up in the morning, there was nothing to eat in his house, literally nothing, and he'd walk around hungry. His first stop of the day was he'd go to some white man's house, turn on the faucet on the outside lawn hose, and fill his belly with as much water as he can, because that would stop the hunger pangs. And he said it worked for a little while. When his stomach was filled with water, it wouldn't hurt, until that water passed from his body, and then he was more hungry than he was before. Here's an interesting thought. If a person has a need to grow, if a person has a need to grow in legitimate, real things that Hashem put him on the planet for, what happens if a person doesn't fill those with legitimate things, but puts them, sublimates them, moves them off, misdirects it into other things? For instance, if a person has a legitimate need to grow, but instead of growing in real things, he starts acquiring money and feels that that's my growth, prestige, honor, and starts filling his need to grow with other things, what's going to happen to that person is for a little while he can fool himself, for a little while he can trick himself, but at the core of his essence he's more hungry than he was before, because at the core of his essence he knows it's a bluff. He hungers for real growth, he hungers for real greatness, but what he's filling that desire with are passing silly things. He's filling it with gold and silver, but his neshama, the core of him, knows that it's false. The princess within him knows that it's just trinkets, it's glittery and gold, but it's meaningless. And not only isn't he satisfied, he's more hungry than he was before. And when you see a man who spirals out of control with a need for more power, more prestige, more honor, you're watching a very unmet need for growth. He needs to grow in legitimate, real things. He's trying to fill that with other things, and he's more hungry than he was before. There is a concept in psychology called sublimating. Taking a powerful force, a good, strong force, and misdirecting it, mischanneling it. The Gemara talks about a person who's born with a desire to kill. And the Gemara tells that if a person has a desire to kill, you could sublimate that. You could take that desire and channel it differently. Become a mohel. Become a shochet. Slaughter animals. You have a need to draw blood that doesn't have to be human blood. Take that drive, direct it differently. I've seen with my own eyes an interesting example of sublimating. I was in the airport and I watched a woman take a water bottle, fill up her hands with the water and say, here baby, here, as she held the water for her puppy, her little dog, to come drink from her hands. Oh, baby, baby, baby. When you watch a pet owner treat their pet like it's a live human baby, like it's a live human person, you're watching a very interesting example of this. You see, Hashem gave a woman a maternal instinct. That is an instinct to take care of her young, to take care of babies, to take care of children. When a woman sublimates that, takes that, misdirects it, mischannels it to a dog, you're watching her take one of the greatest powerful emotions that are in the human and she's corrupting it to a dog. Now, it's interesting because psychologists say that it goes so far that if you have a pet owner who fully sublimates this, they'll protect their pets as if they're their own children. They'll actually grieve for their pet when the pet dies. They say, psychologists report, that pet owners will go without food so that their pet could eat. They may even risk life and limb to protect them from harm. Now, if you think that's an exaggeration, you don't have to go too far to see this b'chush. There is an entire section of Hallmark cards that are dedicated to bereavement. Now, bereavement's an appropriate thing to have cards for. You know, you have a loss in the family, you send the person a card. But they're pet bereavement cards, as in, oh, you lost Fido, oh, here's a card. Now, there are pet cemeteries, pet urns, pet memorials, pet condolence cards. I went online because I was curious. And now, Ashes to Ashes sells a very interesting thing called the Pet Loss Care Package. Now, let me use their words to describe it. The Pet Loss Care Package is designed to help fill your time of grief with meaningful healing activities of journaling, remembrance, and ceremony. But the problem is, it's for your pet loss. How about a memory pendant? It's a beautiful and thoughtful way to celebrate the life and keep the memory alive of a cherished pet. You're not convinced yet? How about an angel's destiny? Our website is devoted to letting grieving pet owners know that they are not alone. Let a friend, family member, or loved one know you care by sending a pet bereavement gift box. Accent the memorial garden you've created in your companion's honor with a dog angel or cat angel. Ah, nice, nice. Now here's a very important question to focus on. How fulfilled do you think a woman is when she sublimates a very powerful instinct in her to care for young, and she misdirects that to a dog? How fulfilled do you think she is? You see, at the core of her essence, she knows it's folly, it's foolish. A dog is a dog, a human baby is a human baby, and the two cannot be confused. But if you confuse them and you misdirect them, at the core of your essence, you're unhappy because you're taking a very powerful feature that Hashem gave you and you're misdirecting it. And so too, when a human being takes a very, very powerful force within him that Hashem gave him to grow, to accomplish, to really make himself into something, but he misdirects that to honor, to prestige, to money, and says, I'm growing, look at me, my bank account, my honor, my prestige, look at my name, people know me. He's taking a very, very powerful force and misdirecting it. And if you wonder why he's not happy, you're beginning to understand the reason why. If you have a need to grow, and growth means in real, proper things, and you're not growing, you will not be happy. And I think Mr. Lasharm tells us that answer. He says, if the neshama ever gets this point clearly, if I ever get the point that I was put on this planet to grow in real things, and I focus on that, then the neshama, the soul, loves this world. Why? Because this world is the only opportunity to do exactly that, to grow. You see, of all of the creations, man and man alone can grow. Dogs, pets do not grow. Angels do not grow. Of all the creations in the entire world, the only creation that can grow is Adam. Man was placed, the neshama placed into this body, put into this world with this golden opportunity to change, to mold myself, to make myself into a different person. If the neshama, if the eye recognizes that and I use that life appropriately, then I'm happy. Why? Because that's what I was created for. Hashem created the person, put him on a planet to grow, and if you use the tool appropriately, if you use your pen to write with it, works very well. As a toothpick, it's pretty lousy. So too man. If you use man appropriately as a tool that he is, a tool for growth, a tool for accomplishment, then he's quite happy. But if you use that need to grow, if you use man for any use other than what Hashem created it for, you will not be happy. And my friends, I believe that that exactly is the answer to Adam and Chava. You see, when Adam and Chava blew it, they blew it big time. They were put in Gan Eden, given the opportunity to grow with such an accelerated rate that it's hard for us to even imagine. Not only didn't they grow, they did the opposite. They brought themselves so lowly, they brought themselves so down that they changed the entire existence. They changed themselves and they changed human history, and they knew it. And within them, there was a real sense of guilt, a real sense of what did we do? And now, if they were put in that mind frame, put out of Gan Eden, they would have felt embarrassed, they would have felt naked, they would have made themselves clothing, and they would have had a tremendous need to feel, look at us, we've now put on clothing. We used to run around naked, now we put on clothing. Maybe I could sort of pin that on some sort of growth, maybe we're higher, maybe we're better now, and there is an argument to be made, after all, now it's tznius, now we're modest, we're wearing clothing. Within them, they would have needed to feel a sense of growth. They would have attributed to this external clothing. They would have felt, wow, look at us, we're now Bali Milo, we're on a higher level. And they would have deluded themselves, they would have fooled themselves to feel that they're now growing, they're now ahead of the game, because that's a huge, huge need in the human. And the human needs that growth. We'll oftentimes attribute it to many other external things. And I think that's exactly what the Sforno is teaching us, that Hashem was afraid, therefore Hashem said, I'll make the kostnosor, I'll make the beged, I'll put it on you so that you don't come to make that mistake. And this concept of a human being's need to grow and also the ability to pin his growth on things that aren't legitimate, I think has some real relevance to us. Let me share with you a few examples. I've seen with my own eyes a yeshiva guy who during his yeshiva years was a big masmid, very into learning, into davening, into Yerushamayim, Midos, everything good, he's growing. Great guy. Gets married, goes to work, and starts making it big. Starts making a lot of money. His company becomes very successful. And you see, he's a very different person. Learning, not anymore. Davening, sure, what it used to be. Midos, Yerushamayim, all that stuff is gone. And you wonder, what's pshat? What, you forget why you're here? You make money, you're out working, got to do that because you have a family support. So, but what happened to your purpose in existence? I believe what happened really is a quite simple thing. When he was in yeshiva, he had something that was propelling him, his need to grow. And he filled that need to grow with legitimate real things, namely Yerushamayim, learning, midos, the things that he was really put on the planet to grow for, and he was fulfilling exactly that purpose. When he got out of yeshiva, now found himself in the workplace, he found a substitute. I'm making money. My company is growing. I'm becoming a person of means. And now there was a substitute for his need to grow that allowed him to delude himself to feel that, look at me, I'm growing. I'm now accomplishing. And no longer did he wake up in the morning with a hunger to grow. He was able to sublimate it, to misdirect it to this thing called reputation, honor, money, whatever it might have been. And he lost one of the great rockets that drove him to his original greatness. And that, my friends, is a very real danger. If you find yourself in a position where you're growing in money, reputation, honor, acceptance in the community, if you find yourself really growing in any other way, that's great. You should continue it. but also be aware that it's somewhat dangerous, because you could easily feel that you need to grow, that which is really your main drive to accomplish can be met in those areas, and you may rob yourself of one of the great powerhouses that might drive you to grow, and you may lose it. And that's one example of this concept that I think is nogea. But I think there's another example that might also ring true. A guy wakes up in the morning and says, you know what, not enough. I'm not satisfied, I want to accomplish more, I want to do more. And what does he do? He decides, that's it, I'm putting on the black hat. That's not enough, I'm putting on a Bekesher, a Gartel, thick briskapeus, I'm taking it on all, and he sets himself on a new course. It may well be that that decision was the most crippling decision this fellow ever made in his life. Why? Because right now, after he's done it, the black hat, the Gartel, the payas, the whole nine yards, he has now arrived. He's certainly frumer than you, and he's very, very frum. So now when he comes to shul, he feels very complacent, very smug in the fact that I have grown. Because just look at me. Look in the mirror. You see how I've grown. And what he's done is he's robbed himself of a very real need to grow. Now, gentlemen, don't get me wrong. There is a place for externalization. There is a place for chitzonius. If you put on the black hat because you want to identify with a group, and you take on the rest of the package, and that means all the rest of what comes with it. If you put on the briskapeus, but you put it on because you're buying into an entire mindset, then that's a very good thing, because it helps you identify, helps you become a part of that, and maybe a tool for growth. But if you hop the external, if you grab the chitzonius, but don't take the pnimius, what you're doing is you're potentially robbing yourself of one of the great mechanisms for growth, because now I've arrived. Just look how thick those payas are. I'm frumer than the Pope. There's nobody as frum as me. And the real danger is not even gaiva. The real danger is complacency. I am, what do you mean, grow more? I've arrived. I'm there. And I've heard my Rebbe, the Reshiva, say many, many times, chitzonius, externals, are very, very dangerous. They have their place, but you have to be very, very guarded in how you use them. You have to use them very carefully. And especially in our day and age, we live in a very external times. We live in times when it's all shtick, it's all the chitzonius, it's all the outside, it's your appearance. And just listen to how people talk when they're going on shidduchim. They rate people on the most external, trivial things. And you quickly recognize the danger involved. It has a place that has to be very, very carefully guarded. So the first way that a person can misdirect his drive for greatness is by acquiring money, position, power. The second way a person can misdirect his need for growth is in external things. I believe that in America today, there's a third way that I don't believe ever existed in the course of history. There's another way that a person can blunt his need for growth, and I'd like to share with you what that is. I once heard, said over the name of Noach Weinberg, the following observation. He said, when a 10-year-old, what happens when a 5-year-old starts acting like a 2-year-old? The parents immediately are very concerned. They bring in the child for observation. We have to see what's wrong. What happens when a 10-year-old acts like a 5-year-old? No longer is observation. It's called for now, it's intervention. We have to get serious. What happens when a 15-year-old acts like a 7-year-old? It's time to institutionalize the child. But, says Rav Weinberg, what happens when a 65-year-old acts like a 15-year-old? That's called retirement. You're retired. Play all day. Just play all day. I had a woman say to me, I went down to a certain retirement community, and that's all they were doing, playing all day. Just playing. Games. That's all they did. And a woman said to me these words. She said, it's great. It's like sleepaway camp for adults. All year round. And that's what they do, from activity to activity, have the movies and the shuffleboard, and maybe there's a little more active as ping pong, and they do games and distractions all day long. And my friends, America has discovered something called distraction, and it's touted as the American way, and it's the great accomplishment. You can retire and do what? Do nothing, play all day, just play your games. And you'll find retirement community after retirement community that brags exactly that. Now here's an interesting thing to think about. If Hashem created the human being to grow, if Hashem put us on the planet specifically for that purpose, placed within us a huge, huge need to grow, to accomplish, to better ourselves, What do you think the life satisfaction level is of a person who's 70 years old, understands the game, and now spends his time at the shuffleboard court? Look at me, the king of shuffleboard. I am it. I have arrived. What do you think the neshama of that person is saying? What do you think the core of their essence that they feel? Benjamin Franklin had an interesting line about retirement. He said, retirement is fine as long as it doesn't interfere with your work. You see, he had an understanding of what a person is here to do, to grow, to accomplish, to do things. And retirement is a fine thing as long as it doesn't interfere with your life's work. But that's not quite what you see as the American dream. And I'd like to share with you a very, very important question that you should ask yourself right now. That question that you should ask yourself right now is, what am I going to do when I retire? Let me explain to you why that's so important. If you spend your years, let's say from 25 to 65, diligently working, which you should do, Parnassah is a serious all, it's a serious responsibility, you have a family to support and you have to take that seriously. But if you take your years of 25 to 65 focused on working and your career, whatever it may be, lawyer, doctor, Indian chief, whatever you're doing for a living, and that becomes your life, you know what you're going to find? It consumes you, it defines you, it is you. Then there's going to come a certain point when the game is over. You retire. You're no longer a lawyer, a doctor, an Indian chief. You've now retired, and the entire thing called your life is gone. And now what? Now what? What do? I don't know. Play hopscotch? Nope, too old for that. Shuffleboard, that's it. Great. I'm the king of ping pong. What do? What was your life, what you spent all your energy, your focus, your entire existence focused on is now removed. And now you find yourself empty and you got a whole day to fill. But there's nothing to fill it with. That understanding, I think, is very eye-opening. There's a car magnet that's running around. I had a life, but my job ate it. If you had a life and then your job ate it, what you're going to find is that you're not just defined by your job, but when your job ends, you've ended. And a person who wants to grow in life must find many, many other areas in which they're growing. And that means while you're working diligently and responsibly, you also have many goals and many objectives that you set yourself to work on. There are midos. I'm going to work on being a better, nicer person. I'm going to be more careful in the way I speak to people, a better husband, a better father. I'm going to work on Yerushalayim. And that means I'm davening with a different sense of kavana. I'm learning. Learning is a lifetime occupation. If you set yourself goals outside of work, you become a person who's growing, who's accomplishing, and you become a person who's doing what is put on the planet for. But if not, you find yourself at 65, at 70, riding the bicycle, running around the retirement community, as so many others are, and you find yourself empty at the core of your existence. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from two questions. Question number one is, why isn't man happy? Question number two is, why does man constantly need to grow? The answers are because that's what Hashem put us on the planet to do. Hashem put us here to grow, to accomplish. If you're doing that, you neshama, you love this world because it's a grand opportunity. Every day is a sale day. Every day is a day of accomplishment. But if you're living your life for any other purpose, you're going to find yourself empty. You're going to find yourself unhappy. And as 85 or 95% of Americans, you could have it all. Wealth, luxuries, pleasures, it's all at your fingertips, but you're not genuinely happy. Why not? Because you're taking that huge need to grow and you're sublimating it, you're misdirecting it to other things, and you're not satisfied, you're not happy. That concept of misdirecting something is what the Sunnah is teaching us, that Hashem was afraid by two of the greatest people ever created, by Adam and Chava. They needed to grow. And when they found themselves out of Gan Eden, they would have taken that need and misdirected it to put on clothing and feel we've arrived, because that is a real danger. Misdirecting that and hooking it onto some external thing is a real danger, because on some level it makes me feel better. On some level it makes me feel like I grew, but like that fellow who would drink water to fill his empty stomach, once the water passes, you're more hungry than you were before, and it just doesn't fill my soul. Anything else, money, trappings, honor, all of the luxuries that the world brings, doesn't fill my soul, and I'm more hungry than I was before. If a person wants to be happy, he has to fill that need, but fill that need with real things, real growth, real eternal growth. And ultimately, that's the way to gain happiness. Ultimately, that's the way to grow and become a great individual. I'd like to close with a story that Rabbi Hanoch Teller told me recently. He said that Rav Aaron Kotler was approached by a certain balabos looking for a shidduch for his daughter. This gentleman came down to Lakewood and was sitting in Rav Aaron's office. It was back in the 50s, so he asked him legitimately for the best bacher in Lakewood. And back then, there might have been one best bacher in Lakewood. So Rav Aaron's going through the names of different bacherim, this one, that one, and this balabos noticed that in the office, back and forth, is a young man who comes in and leaves, comes in and leaves. And during their conversation, this young man has clear entry into Rav Aaron's office. At a certain point, the balabos says to himself, if this young man has such a shaykhah, such a close relationship with Rav Aaron that he's always in and out of the office, maybe he's a fine candidate. So he says to Rav Aaron, what about that bacher? What about the fellow who comes in and out? What about him for my daughter? Rav Aaron turns to him and says, him? If I don't keep my eye on him every moment, he'll blow up the world. That young man got married, moved to Eretz Yisrael, and single-handedly created one of the most powerful Torah networks that exist today, maybe the most powerful Torah network that was ever created in history. You see, Rav Aaron saw something in this young man. He saw a powerhouse. But a powerhouse can go this way or can go that way. Misdirected, he could blow up the world. Who knows how much trouble to create? Directed appropriately, he built one of the most powerful Torah networks that may have ever existed. And that's the man. That's Adam. The human being was given tremendous potential. But that potential is a very dangerous thing. If you misdirect it, if you push it to anything else, you'll squander your existence, you'll squander life. Who knows how much trouble you'll cause for others and yourself. But take that huge need for growth, that huge need to accomplish, direct it properly and you'll reach the stars, you'll reach great heights. But that's one of the great secrets, reaching into the core of your essence, understanding your need for growth and using it appropriately. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom, understanding and the ability to put this into practice in our lives.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozing free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.